Chairman, friends, before I enter a discussion of my subject, I would like to say how delighted I am to be with you this afternoon and also to spend these 2 days with you, sharing my experience as well as hearing your experiences, as I heard this morning. From India, I come and I bring to you the greetings of my people and my church. I would say it is a great joy for me to be here. And I especially thank Ms. Banger for inviting me to come here and to spend these 2 days with you. Before I speak, I would also like to say it is a bit audacious on my part, facing many veteran missionaries in different parts of the globe, to speak on the importance of the indigenous church. However, since I have been given that subject, and also since I come from a church which has become truly indigenous to the Indian soil, perhaps you might justify my speaking to you on this subject. But before I speak anything about the importance of the indigenous church, I would like to draw your attention to the background over which we have to think of the importance of the indigenous church. The entire world is undergoing revolutionary changes in this generation, the extent of which defies description. Nevertheless, among the most obvious evidences of this worldwide upheaval, the following may be noted. One, the emergence of new nations and last stages of colonialism. Two, the renaissance of ancient religions. Three, the unparalleled advances of science, including the development of atomic power. Four, the transformation of agricultural in industrial society with all the social, economic, and political structural transformations involved. Five, the struggle between communism and Western powers and within the respective orbits of power and the continuing threat of war. The whole mission of the church and the life of the younger churches have to be seen in the light of these revolutionary changes. For our old methods and techniques of mission work are no more workable effectively for the spread of the gospel. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, all the rest will be added unto you. This was the motto of some of our earlier missionaries, and they were quite contented with just preaching the word and baptizing without entering any more into the problems of the people to which they were talking. Of course, it worked in some places and in many places, but one has to take into consideration the great revolution that is happening today all over the world, especially in the eastern countries, and should begin to view the life, I mean the human life, as a whole. Christianity has to give final answer to all the problems of life. And a church that fails to take into consideration all these cannot succeed in the advancement of the mission of the church. We must understand that though there was Christianity in India from the earliest Christian century, and though India was under Great Britain, a Christian nation, a Christian government, 150 years, yet Christianity in India is only just 2%, 8 or 9 million in its large population of 360 million people. What I am going to say mainly concerns India, and I should say that it is a pattern for the rest of East Asia and even Africa. A great revolution is taking place in all these countries. The things which distinguish this present revolution from all the rest so far are, one, the fact that it is so widespread. Two, that it reaches down to the very foundation of our social life and existence. Vast areas of Asia, Africa, Latin America are in its grip. And in each of these areas, the basic social units, such as the family, the caste or class, the religions, the languages, are beginning to disintegrate. The old pattern of culture is being attacked by new forces. I shall mention just three. One, the new ideas of individual freedom and social equality, which are beginning to undermine the community emphasis of family and caste. In India, for example, untouchability has been legally abolished. You know, India, Hinduism is divided into different castes. The low caste people are considered to be untouchable, and they never had any equality of rights and equality of opportunities. But today, since India became free in 1948, there is no more untouchability, because the Indian constitution has taken it away and has given them complete freedom and equality. Not only equality, the so-called untouchables and outcasts are specially favored today. Some people today, some outcast people today, want specially to point out that they are outcasts because of the special privileges and opportunities they get in the government as otherwise. So you see, the untouchability, that thing is now legally and technically gone from India, though in some places it dies hard, just as in any other place. Then again, another thing is, love marriages instead of arranged marriages are beginning to take place. About 50 years ago, people were married so young. But today, those things are changing. The marriages were arranged for the young people. They had seldom opportunities of meeting together or arranging their own marriages. But today you find the young people go to the same school, college, they work on the same counter in the office. Naturally, they meet each other, fall in love with each other, and make their own arrangements in marriage. So one would say, how suddenly things are changing. The whole social bulwark of society is changing rapidly. Furthermore, people who have traditionally been at the bottom of social scale are beginning to demand their rights. You can't simply, if you go to India today or to many of the Eastern countries, you find people fighting for their rights, people who have been downtrodden for centuries, or throughout the existence of their particular society, now fighting for their rights and their equality with other people. Secondly, there is the movement towards national unity. There is a new awareness that the major problems of society can be solved only as a people working together as a nation. So you find the government planning. If you go to India today, you find all the different plannings which the government do. The 5-year plan that really includes everything one can really think of. Government planning. National reconstruction. You go everywhere, schools are built, hospitals are built, special places of training, industrialization coming into this end, and so forth. So you find that everything is planned today on a national scale. And these things are often the words which you hear is spoken in the street. So far it has become so common. National reconstruction, government planning, these are all have become phrases heard very often today. This means that as government is given more and more power, regional and communal loyalties must give away. It is a great change, revolution. Formerly you find that there was a unit in a village. There was the village headman. He was all in all in the village. But today, and there again, formerly you find the old Maharajas, about 600 of them, ruling as feudal lords. But today it's all gone. India is a well-knit federal state, with the result that the parochial, provincial, village loyalties is disappearing. In its place, all-powerful government, the central government, coming in its place. So you find that the old communal loyalties, the regional and village loyalties are disappearing. Then thirdly, or the third factor, is the impact of Western technology. The feeling is now widespread that only through technology can the economic problem be solved. One aspect of this is that industrialization has become for many the answer to nearly every problem, that is unemployment, underdevelopment, poverty, etc. If you take, for example, the 5-year plan of India, you find a steady program of industrialization planned for India. One of the things which India is hoping to have in the next 5 years is steel production. India has got one of the largest iron ores in the world. So there is a very great scope for the steel industry, and steel industry is a basic industry. But two things India lacks. One is the technological skill, Secondly, money needed for investing in these big projects. For the technological skill, according to the 5-year plan, India is sending abroad 800 Indian engineers every year for the next 5 years, so that by the end of the fifth year, there will be 4,000 steel engineers trained and come back to India. We have today, for example, in this state, in this country, 200 Indian steel engineers working. 60 of them are living with me in the International House in Chicago. There are some working in Germany, some working in Britain, some in Canada, and some in Russia. So in the 5-year plan, at the end of it, in 1961, steel will begin to be produced. And when one steel is produced, it becomes the basic industry, and from which several other industries will come out. In other words, what I would like to say is that the great process of industrialization in India, as well as in all the countries in the East, becoming very important in many, but that is where we are concerned. This has meant in many cases the breakdown of the idea of the village as the primary economic unit. That is the revolution that is happening. The foundations of traditional pattern of society are beginning to shake. But what is more important, nothing new has emerged to take its place. In some cases, the old is trying to adapt itself to new. For example, you find Hinduism is striving to absorb all the new ideas into its framework and revive the foundations of national culture in the light of that. But how far it is succeeding, one can't say. In other cases, we find only destruction and chaos. In case of urbanization, millions of village people have migrated to the cities to find a job. They are free of their traditional patterns of life, but nothing has replaced it. All moral and social controls are gone. There is a loss of direction. People drift into the red light district or into gangs, chaos, despair. Dehumanization has filled the vacuum. Sometimes people in America tell me, "Oh, you people in India and in the East are all very religious and mystic people. You are more concerned with the other world." Well, I would say that is not right. There is sometimes a feeling that the whole of East is mystic and the whole of West is materialistic. Both are wrong. Because we find in the East, the same materialism is flourishing. Only thing is that we have not enough material to think about. But one, when it comes, I'm afraid, the mystic East also will turn materialistic. And not only that, my problem is that all the problems today in the West is coming to the East very soon, with its industrialization, with its great revolution that is taking place. All that we find today in the West is tragedies. Everything is coming to the East. But here I find that there are the churches, there are the societies, there are the welfare institutions who think about this problem and try to solve and find ways and means to face them. But in the East, I sometimes feel a little despondent when I think of 15 or 20 or 25 years hence. What is going to come to the East when all this industrialization and all the tragedy is connected with it come to the East? Is there sufficient religious strength to face it? Now, I just gave you this little bit of background just to think about our problem in the light of this. Because this is the atmosphere in which the church is called upon to make its witness to Jesus Christ. In Asia, the church has never become an integral part of its culture and is viewed as an outsider and as a representative of the West. But having said this, we must go on to say that the church has now been presented with an opportunity for making its voice heard in a decisive way. The whole society is in transition, and the church must strike when the iron is hot. The church must think deeply about the questions raised by this great social revolution that is sweeping all over the East and in over Africa. For they are really questions that man is asking about his own nature. In its life and mission, it must seek to deal with them in terms of the revelation of Jesus Christ. I would like to point out three important frontiers for the church to work. One, the frontier of culture. The traditional culture is breaking down, just as I said. The old culture and its different aspects is centered on an agricultural community with the village life and the head of the family. Those are all now breaking. In some cases, the church is partly responsible for its breaking up. For example, the great opinion for removing caste from India, I would say Christianity has given the inspiration. Gandhi, who has been a long time in the West and had been greatly influenced by the Christian religion, especially Jesus Christ and his great message. Where did he get his inspiration of removing the caste? I would say the church is mainly responsible. And again, you find that most of the Indian leaders who became social reformers had great influence on their life by the Christian church. But it should not simply tear up the old existing things. God, we know, is a God of order, and he does not expect man to live in moral and social chaos. The church must begin to think anew of its relationship to social order. Or in other words, the church should begin to relate the gospel of Jesus Christ to the social revolution. The second frontier is nation building. Just as I said, in every sphere of life, nations, the newborn independent countries are building up. Nation building, programs of so many things, reconstruction, planning, things like that. So that is a frontier in which the church can enter and cooperate and become identified with its own people in the building of the nation. Then thirdly, there is the frontier of personal suffering and misery. Here you find, especially in the East, in India, in China, or Japan, or Indonesia, people suffering because of all of poverty, sickness, disease. Now, the church must have a message of hope for these people that is relevant to their needs. It is very easy to tell them, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all the rest will be added unto you. It's very easy, but people won't take it seriously. You have to enter into the problem, into their need, and see how the church can really give the great message of hope. What I would like to point out is that unless the mission or unless the church is going to enter into the whole aspect of man's life, it is not going to do its work properly. Now, it is here I find the importance of the indigenous church. Now, what is the indigenous church? What does it actually mean? When I was thinking about the subject, suddenly one sentence, I think, from Abraham Lincoln came to my mind when he spoke about democracy or democratic state. Government of the people, for the people, by the people. In the same way, a church of the people, by the people and for the people. I would say that is the indigenous church. Now, let us see, is it necessary? Well, whether we like it or not, we are driven to it now. It has become a very necessary thing indeed. For we find in many countries today, foreign missionary is not greatly welcomed by the governments of the state. From China, every foreign missionary has left, is gone. Very few perhaps remain, and they themselves cannot do any mission work. So unless the Chinese church becomes indigenous, how can it really work or evangelize uphold the mission of the church? In India, in 1947, India became free. And in about a year's time, India drew its constitution. According to the constitution of India, there are three phrases that gives religious freedom to the citizens of India. It is to practice, to preach, and to propagate. Every Indian citizen is free to practice, to preach, and to propagate his religion. So according to the Constitution of India, every Indian citizen has got complete religious freedom, according to the Constitution. So you find that in 1948, when the Constitution came into being, there was a great influx of missionaries to India. I am told that in a year or two, the number of the missionaries in India, foreign missionaries in India, became just the double in 2 years after after India became free. But mostly these missions came from the so-called sects of this country. And I would like to say that in the next 2 or 3 years' time, there had been some certain tensions which partly created some trouble for the missionaries in India. It was partly, missionaries were also partly responsible for that. The responsibility did not come from the well-established missions, but I would say mostly from the so-called sex missions, people who have suddenly come to India without knowing any of the background of the Indian people and going about here and there and doing things. So much so that in 2 or 3 years' time, one Madhya Pradesh appointed a committee, the Niyogi committee, they appointed to draw up certain things about the mission. And this Niyogi report was very, very disastrous to the foreign missionary especially. So when it was published, there was very great protest from all the Christian missions and Christian churches in India. And we find questions were asked in the parliament. When the questions were asked in the parliament, the government said, Christian members of the parliament pointed out, look here, the constitution of India. Here you say that every Indian citizen is free to practice, preach and propagate his religion. Why now this discrimination? Then the India government, that is quite true. But that is the freedom of the citizen of India, not for a foreigner to come and claim for it. We might, out of our charity, might give it to them. But the foreigner cannot come and claim that. Anyhow, we find that from that time onward, there are certain restrictions put on the foreign missionary, with the result that there is slowly and steadily the number of the foreign missionary becomes less and less. Or in other words, I would say, the necessity of the indigenous church, a church that can proclaim the gospel by the people, for the people, is becoming a great necessity, at least in India. Of course, that is now spreading in other countries. And again, you find that a church that does not identify with the nationalism of that country becomes foreign to that particular country. For example, a church in Arab countries today, a church that cannot fully understand Arab nationalism cannot live in the Arab country. The church should become the church of that people, unless it can do it. And also, it should also become slowly and steadily identify with the culture of the people. We find in India, when there was a fight for freedom for a number of years, certain Christians were accused of siding with Britain because they were Christians and they belonged to the foreign religion. But fortunately, in the freedom fight, there were many, many Christians involved, with the result that Christians were respected and greatly honored in the whole thing. Now, when we think about the possibility of the indigenous church, a certain problem comes up. Does it mean that there should not be any foreign missionary? Does it mean that there should not be any foreign help? Does it mean that there should not be any foreign leadership? At the beginning of the church, all these are necessary, especially in a mission. But the whole aim of the mission of the church should be slowly to train up this young church to take up the leadership. From the very beginning itself, one should try to make the church self-supporting. The people should begin to contribute money for the upkeep of the church. without contributing money, you can't have the full interest of the people in it. You see, our church was existing these 16 years, according to Mr. Banger, I would say from the first century onwards. They are in India, and all of these years, the church was self-supporting. Not a single penny at any time of the existence of the church has come from foreign countries. Only we have occasionally contributed some money to some other churches. But it is not a rich church. And yet, its ministry is fully met. Its ministries are supported by its own people. We have no endowment. People give one way or the other. So, from the beginning of the mission, you should try to train the people to give, not only to receive, to begin to give the church, and slowly you must develop this self-supporting church. Especially in the ordinary pastoral work. But there are certain projects in which the mother churches can greatly help in giving a great push. For example, I would say, when you think of a theological institution, it is very important for a church to become indigenous. There should be a theological institution, and the theological institution should slowly develop the leadership of the church and its ministry. Now, a good theological institution cannot be started or fully financed by a small mission church, a younger church. So, the great responsibility of starting it, financing it, and even producing teachers to teach theology and developing it slowly must be taken up by the mother church. But as far as the ordinary pastoral concern or pastoral work is concerned, from the very start, from the very beginning of the church, it should be taught to take up responsibility and also to maintain its own clergy. Then comes the question of the indigenization of worship. Now that is a very, very important thing. Now, often you find that in the mission churches, there are, the worship is so Western, one doesn't feel that you are, if you come, I have not taken part in any of the Lutheran worship in India, but I have taken part in other Protestant churches, for example, the Church of England, or some other place. You get the same prayer book, translated in the vernacular, and just having the same tunes of chant for the psalter and everything, which becomes sound so Western. But one thing, I mean, if the church should become truly indigenous, the worship should be the expression of the people, the expression of the culture of the people, the color, the light, the changes you find there, and the singing and everything should become. If you take the history of the church was just like that. You take, for example, the early liturgies of the church. In the West, you have the Roman Missal, the Roman Mass, which you find quite different from the Eastern liturgy, the Byzantine liturgy. Again, if you take the Eastern liturgies, you find Byzantine liturgy is Greek, and it is different from the Oriental liturgies, which had its origin in Syria, or the liturgy which we use in India. Every place you find that there should be a place or a way in which the indigenous nature of the people, the indigenous expression of the people can be brought into the worship. But that is not very easy. It is a very difficult task. There are sometimes people go with a craze of indigenization, with the result that the whole beauty of Christian worship is completely lost. And you get something which is neither indigenous nor Western, neither Christian nor pagan. So for heaven's sake, though don't go with this craze of indigenization, which would result in a thing like that. But it must be a great concern for the home church to develop the indigenous worship of the church wherever this church is. Another thing comes up. If you again take the history of the church, if you go through the development of Christian thought through centuries, you find that the interpretation of Christian theology from time to time in different places often took indigenous expression. If you take the Alexandrian school, you get the Alexandrian school slowly taking in Greek philosophy, and through the medium of Greek philosophy interpreting Christian theology. In the course of history, you find this is continued. St. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, or later, it comes up like that. So, one thing one has to remember is this interpretation of theology must not be completely confined to the Western philosophy alone. For example, if one studies the Hindu philosophy, you might see so much through which you can express your Christian theology. So when the church becomes indigenous, there must be an effort on the part of the church to express its theology through its own language and through its own philosophy. At least an effort should be made to make use of indigenous philosophy in the interpretation of its theology. Now there again there is a danger. Wherever such attempt is taken, there can come a dangerous syncretism. Sometimes you find the same thing in India today. Some of the Christian thinkers who wanted to express the Christian theology through Indian language and through Indian philosophy have been accused or alleged of this great crime of syncretism. So one should again be beware of this great danger of syncretism in reinterpreting one's theology through indigenous channels and indigenous language. I think I have more or less covered what I have to say. Only thing which I have to mention finally, the last, that it is a great need, the indigenous church, because the great revolution that is sweeping all over the world today, especially in the East and in Africa, really, if that should be met, it can be met only by an indigenous church. It is very, very important. And also, one has to bear in mind all the dangers that might come in the process of indigenization. So, this process is very urgent. This is very important. But at the same time, it is also beset with great danger, and therefore should be proceeded with extreme care and by the great grace of God, because it is He whom we preach. It is His service we are doing. And all what we do, indigenization or otherwise, it is actually the extension of His kingdom and the preaching of His gospel. Thank you.
you, Father Philippus. In fact, you know, the Syrian church has a lot of things it can teach us. In our own culture, you know, in our own school sometimes too, I think we interpret everything from the Greek point of view. The Syrian church and the Syrian tradition has a lot to teach us, especially in the understanding of the gospel. And I'm sure it has a lot to teach us in this idea of indigenization. And I'm sure all of us feel that this empty ghost-like word, indigenization, was given a lot of flesh by your inspiring talk. Thank you very much. Perhaps we have 5 minutes in which we could ask Father Philippus a question or two.
Indian constitution at present gives freedom in religion mainly to the Indian national, the subject of the government of India. Do you feel that it would be advisable, or do you feel that it behooves a missionary out of Christian love to become a citizen of your country in order that he might carry on the work that he has come to India to do?
It would certainly help him, because if he becomes an Indian citizen, then nobody can put any control over you. You need not come away for your furlough and get a non-objection visa or something like that. Certainly, if one decides to stay on in India and become an Indian citizen, it will greatly help one's role as an evangelist or a missionary. I would also like to add one thing, that it does not mean that India does not need any missionary at all. In fact, even today it's only 2% Christian. India still needs any number of missionaries, but the fields in which a missionary can work is becoming more and more limited. So the mission work may be done not through the old traditional ways. Perhaps a missionary come as a great doctor and do wonderful thing there. A missionary may be able to come as a great teacher and do wonderful work through his witnessing that way. But just as a missionary to come to India is the one thing that the government finds difficult to entertain.
I was also interested in your mentioning the liturgical and worship forms. Does your church in India use a liturgical form of worship, or if not, what type does it use?
We follow the ancient St. James liturgy.
Has that been put into the...
It's done in Malayalam, in the vernacular.
I don't mean just the language, I mean the musical sense.
No, not quite. I would say it's partly because, you know, this Eastern music is very much nearer to Indian music than Western music. Mostly its music is Syrian. But by its great association with the country for the past so many centuries, it has become so indigenous. But that doesn't mean that when it leaves that particular area to go to another place, it will be indigenous there at all. Because India has got different languages and different music and things like that. So when you translate it into another language, say for example Hindi, which we have not so far done, because we are only in the south yet, we will have to accept certain musical things from the Hindi language. But it should be done.
Has any of that been recorded? Is it available at all?
I don't think so. No.
That would be a wonderful project to come on. Thank you very much.
You've mentioned, Doctor, that the Indian Constitution provides for freedom of religion and the abolition of the caste system. May I ask, has that been carried out fully in actual fact, or is that just a provision of the Constitution which has not yet been completely executed?
Number one, about the religion, it is, it can be fairly said that the Constitution is kept except that there have been a few cases of local incidents. But that is purely local. When it was questioned by, when it was reported in the central government, there was questions concerning it. We could say on a federal central government level, it is absolutely kept the letter. But on a local level, you know, in certain places there may be certain enmities which find expert in through religious channels. And the other thing is about the caste, it is also on the governmental level, it is absolutely kept. But in some places, it dies off.
What is the present numerical strength of the Syrian church, and have you any missionaries going into other parts of India from your area?
The present strength of the church comes nearly a million, and mostly centered in the south, in the state of Kerala. But we have now churches in most of the important cities of India, like Bombay, Calcutta, Delhi, Calicut, most of the important places. And the church in Malabar, that is the Syrian church, has not been a great missionary church at all in the past. But I would say in the last 30, 35, 40 years, there has been a great renewal of the church going on in different various fields. And the resources, which really resulted in great missionary activity. One missionary activity of the church, called the Servants of the Cross, as in the last 25 years, they are celebrating their 25th anniversary, that is the Silver Jubilee, last year or so, and they have now converted and baptized 25,000 untouchables. They are a body who really do work among the untouchables. But the difference about your mission and our mission is that your mission is highly organized and well-manned and with your home missions and things like that, properly supported. Because we are not a rich church, we cannot have any big organization like that. Some people feel convinced that they are called by God. They go into the mission field. They have nothing, I mean, no funds or anything. They just do the work. Some people who are attracted to him follow him. The founder of the Servants of the Cross was just like that. He was a school teacher, Peter. He was a school teacher and he was headmaster of a school. He got a call. He felt that he had a call to do missionary work. He went to Serampore and he had his education, theological education that way, and came back and left his job. He had about 5,000 rupees of his personal savings, that is $1,000. He went with that. He traveled from one village to the other village. Some young people, seeing his great sacrifice, joined him, and they did not have any capital or any money. The villagers fed them. Their work was among the untouchables in the villages. So from village to village they went. For the last 25 years they had been working like that, with very little capital. But now they have got about 25-30 people. Now the church people give them contributions. But they live on almost nothing, completely sacrificing. And the result is that they have done wonderful work and they have baptized and brought 25,000 souls to Christ. Another work is 5 or 6 of our young men went to Bishop's College, that was the Anglican College, and they were quite sure they are called for missionary work. And they thought they would go to a place where there no missionary has gone. So they went 10 miles outside Coimbatore, called a place called Sadhavan, the principal of this college, who was Bishop Pakenham Wall, was the Bishop of Assam sometimes, he was so thrilled by the enthusiasm of these 5 or 6 young people. So he said, "I'll resign my job and join you." So he also, he and his wife joined them, and they formed into a group, and they went to this place called Sadhavan, built some huts and ashrams there. They lived as an ashram, and they have been now working there for the last 10 years. We have got some religious communities like the Bethany, Mount Tabor, and St. George's Tara, and also one or two women's organizations. They do here and there some little work, but I would say that it is with its resources and with its man, its limited resource and man, slowly trying to become missionary, and young people like me, mostly young or priests of our church, feel convinced that in the future Christianity of India, the Indian church, Church of St. Thomas in India, will have a great contribution to make because of its ancient and indigenous character.